Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2008. Ruination, the early years.
Welcome to Ruination, the early years. I'm King, and I'm ready to dive into the archive, as always, with my expert guide through the marvelous and often messy world of Big Fatty Online.
And I am Gail, and we have truly reached just a monumental week in the history of BFO. We are summarizing 5 full days of content. That's episodes 87 through 91.
Right.
And they run from Monday, June 2nd to Friday, June 6th, 2008.
Okay, and this specific block of episodes, this is a big one.
It is. This is the official, chaotic, and, you know, heavily documented start of Big Fatty's annual pilgrimage to Orlando for Gay Days.
Okay, so let's really unpack this. Our mission today is to analyze exactly how Big Fatty manages this. I mean, this impossible transition. He goes from total domestic disarray, we're talking a dying washing machine, wet underpants.
Literally wet and dirty underpants.
And he has to pivot from that into a tightly scheduled, very public, very complex networking event that he calls the Gay Days Hoot Nanny. This week is the blueprint for how he converts pure chaos into daily compelling content.
It absolutely is. I mean, this set of episodes is just foundational to understanding the BFO content engine. We track his desperate last-minute dash to prepare, the sudden decision to travel early with his longtime travel partner, Larry Cly.
Uh-huh.
Their arrival to Pop Century Resort, and then, you know, the initial whirlwind of theme park visits and these really key social meetups. It's not just travel. It's an operational strategy that, like, weaponizes inconvenience.
We've seen him document his life daily, but taking that level of commitment on the road with all these major logistical hurdles, that is the real spectacle. So let's start with the Monday show, which, well, it immediately tells us about the pressure he was under.
We begin with a classic dose of Big Fatty's structural honesty in episode 87. He confessed right up front that the Monday show was actually recorded late on Sunday night. He doesn't shy away from revealing that production struggle.
And what's significant about that? I mean, isn't he often recording a little bit ahead of time?
He is, but he explicitly noted that he doesn't typically stay up until 2 or 3 in the morning to post immediately. The fact that the recording timeline was already compressing and pushing him to work late on a Sunday night, when he really should have been resting or, you know, packing just to get the Monday episode out, it signals the immense stress his impending travel schedule placed on the content workflow.
Right. It confirms that the commitment to a daily show is paramount, even if it requires sacrificing sleep and, well, his own comfort.
Exactly.
The show starts, as is pretty customary, with a quick review of his media consumption. And this week, he actually ventured out to a movie theater, which, as we know, is a very rare event for him. What did he see, and what was his take?
He hadn't been to the cinema since the Simpsons movie the previous summer, so this was a major outing. He saw Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Oh, wow.
And this is where his, you know, his iconoclastic nature really comes into play.
Mm.
He acknowledged the critical consensus that everyone was saying it was awful and they hated it. But Big Fatty, ever the contrarian, thought it was pretty good.
Yeah, of course he did. It's the perfect way for him to establish his independent voice. He's deliberately standing outside that critical echo chamber.
And he coupled that with his characteristic self-deprecating humor, joking, I guess old people like it.
Ah.
That single line is just a brilliant piece of branding. He embraces his age, he dismisses the critics, and he reinforces his unique perspective, you know, setting the tone that his show will be unfiltered by popular opinion.
But the real logistical drama of this week, before he even left his apartment, it centered around a household appliance failure. So tell us about the infamous laundry crisis, because this is where the ruination aspect of his life really, really shines.
Oh, this is vintage BFO content. It's the specific low-stakes domestic catastrophe that paralyzes the preparations for the high-stakes public event. On Friday night, his washing machine at the Fatty Flat in the Fat Cave.
His nickname for his bachelor apartment.
Right. It died mid-cycle.
And the immediate problem was acute, wasn't it? He couldn't just ignore it and leave town.
No, because the machine failed in the most inconvenient way possible. It filled up with water, but then did nothing, leaving his underpants, quote, wet and dirty. This isn't just a dirty laundry problem. It's a pre-trip clean clothes emergency that compromises his ability to appear professional, or, you know, at least clean, at Gay Days.
So he turns to his community for help first. Who did he call?
He tried the community route immediately. His first attempted fix on Saturday was calling in Miss Kitty, who he notes is pretty good with the mechanical stuff.
Okay.
This highlights the importance of his inner circle, who often serve as his emergency maintenance crew. But even with Miss Kitty's help, they were stymied. They couldn't fix the washer or even successfully take it apart to diagnose the problem. This failure forced him to elevate the problem.
And that forced the call to the professionals.
He had to call Sears and Roebuck for professional service, which immediately put a bummer on his weekend. But the bigger problem was time. He couldn't leave the wet laundry, especially the dirty underpants, sitting for 10 days while he was in Orlando. I mean, that's a biological hazard just waiting to happen.
Yeah, no kidding. So he detailed the extreme manual effort required just to mitigate the disaster before leaving town.
He had to manually bail water out of the machine to prevent the stagnant, dirty water from, fermenting. And then came the true indignity. The return to the washateria, the laundromat, a task he hadn't done in years. He openly admitted he wasn't even sure what the current prices were.
He transforms this mundane chore into almost consumer reporting, doesn't he? Giving his audience the exact logistical details. Why is sharing the cost $1.25 for a load and the time 25 minutes so crucial to his style?
Because it grounds the spectacular in the mundane. His audience doesn't just hear, "I did laundry." They get the specific economics and the temporal commitment required. He brought the clothes home wet, opting to dry them in his apartment, probably draped everywhere.
Oh, I can just picture it.
Rather than spending more money and time at the laundromat. But the anchor point, the successful resolution of the crisis, is that clean underpants were secured for the Orlando trip. The domestic chaos was contained just enough to allow the public-facing content machine to start.
Shifting briefly, he also provided an update on the listener interaction element he checked his KEO box.
He did. He confirmed he received 3 boxes containing items for the upcoming podcast Palooa, which shows that the community is actively sending him supplies for future events, plus a postcard and a letter. It's his way of demonstrating that his physical location in the Fat Cave is a hub for ongoing community activity and physical engagement, not just digital.
And this leads us to how he structured the show around the trip. He knows consistency is key.
Absolutely. He announced a temporary structural shift to manage the travel period. Starting Tuesday and continuing on Thursday, Friday, and the following Monday, he would open the show daily with specific memory lane music related to Disney. This provides a consistent, nostalgic, and thematic anchor, while the actual travel content is inherently chaotic and unpredictable.
And he uses the structure to also plug the rest of the RNL network content.
Yes. He noted that Wednesday's episode would be the necessary exception, featuring the final installment of the miniseries Growing Old and Gray or Gay with Andy Verchales. And he was already scheduling around his return, hoping to have an episode of The Gays on Tuesday, June 10th.
Wow.
It shows his relentless focus. Even while preparing to leave, he's already programming content a week out.
He wraps up the Monday show by noting he's a little petty about going down to the Disney and encourages listeners to enjoy the experience vicariously if they can't join him. The machine is fully prepped, even if his actual laundry was almost ruined.
So we move to Tuesday, June 3rd, episode 88, and immediately the organized chaos of his plan just dissolves into impulsive travel.
Right. Big Fatty and Larry Cly made a sudden, abrupt decision to hit the road after work on Tuesday afternoon, heading toward the Orlando. This was a day earlier than he'd initially planned. What drove this sudden acceleration?
It seems driven purely by the desire to maximize park time and just get a jump on the trip. They plunged into the Gay Days haze, knowing they didn't have a reservation at Pop Century for Tuesday night.
Oh, wow.
The goal was to cover enough distance on Tuesday to ensure they could have a mainly full day of park fun on Wednesday. It's a classic decision to sacrifice comfort and stability, driving tired, potentially scrambling for a room for the ultimate reward of more theme park enjoyment. This is content creation through spontaneous, slightly irresponsible action.
It's fascinating that in the middle of this high-speed, unpredictable travel narrative, he anchors the show by mentioning a massive personal and professional milestone achieved at the coal mine, his workplace.
This is a huge, critical detail that often gets overshadowed by the travel chaos. On June 3rd, he announced that he had reached the point where he can now retire in double digits, specifically 99 days from that date.
Wow.
This is the culmination of years of professional effort.
Why does this detail hold such structural weight for the show, you think?
Because it colors everything.
Yeah.
He framed it perfectly, stating that having the ability to retire is just as good as actually doing it at this point. His entire content production is framed against this backdrop of impending financial and professional freedom. It imbues his often absurd daily struggles with a deeper meaning. These are the last days of a mandatory corporate grind, allowing him to enjoy the BFO life even more. It's a countdown to liberation.
Speaking of the BFO life, he then pivots to his listener community, the Ham Mappers, or the listeners who mark their locations on the digital map. He highlights the continued growth of the network.
This is how he validates his reach. He introduces two new additions this week, showing the network is expanding even as he prepares to travel. First, Luna from Williamsburg, Virginia, whom he immediately nicknames Lunatic.
Of course.
He notes she is new to the BFO universe and hitting the circuit of podcasts, which validates BFO as a necessary stop for new listeners.
And the second entry is classic BFO unfiltered engagement, highlighting the radical, explicit honesty of the show.
That would be Lee, spelled L-E-I-G-H, from Chattanooga, Tennessee, who is described simply as cute. Big Fatty immediately added that Lee was pictured waiting to be touched inappropriately and joked that he would do some Lee.
Oh my gosh.
This reinforces the highly sexualized, non-judgmental, and explicit style of audience interaction that defines the BFO brand. He takes a digital interaction, a map pin, and a photo and converts it instantly into personal, playful commentary, rewarding the listener with attention.
That brings up an interesting juxtaposition. He moves directly from highly personal, localized, and sometimes sexualized content to a massive, looming regional danger. The start of hurricane season in Charleston on June 1st. How does he transition so smoothly to something that serious?
He uses the seriousness of the situation to ground the show in regional reality. This section is a masterclass in combining necessary public service information with bureaucratic absurdity.
Yeah.
He relays the complex logistics for reversing Interstate 26 for mandatory evacuation purposes.
And the details he shared about the potential travel horror are intense.
They are staggering. He estimates 250,000 cars would attempt to leave the Charleston area. The normal 110-mile trip to Columbia, which should take about an hour and a half, is estimated to take 3 to 6 hours during a voluntary evacuation.
Okay, that's bad enough.
During a mandatory evacuation with the I-26 lanes fully reversed, that time jumps to 8 to 10 hours.
That's horrifying. And he highlights a specific logistical absurdity that makes the entire situation feel immediately human and miserable.
The detail that makes the whole scenario relatable is the bathroom situation. During that 8 to 10 hour mandatory trip, he notes there would only be 4 rest stops with portable restrooms between Charleston and Columbia.
Oh no.
This immediately translates a massive infrastructural problem into a deeply personal physical hardship. The shared fear of desperately needing a toilet for 10 hours. It's structural planning colliding with human need, and Big Fatty captures that perfectly.
And he connects this high-level disaster planning back to his own life by sharing his personal history with Hurricane Hugo.
He shares that he stayed for Hurricane Hugo in 1989, which scared the ever-living crap out of me. He uses this experience to provide insight into human behavior during crises, noting the typical paradox. People who stayed last time are leaving next time, and vice versa. It's a very intimate way of handling a huge public topic.
We then get a quick round of voice letters showing the RNL network's wide reach.
Yes. Tim called in, demonstrating the cultural literacy of the BFO audience by correctly identifying the Memory Lane music from a previous show as the theme from the 1982 World's Fair in Knoxville.
Wow.
He even recalled the specific song lyrics. Big Mac, Fish, Quarter Town. It just confirms that the nostalgia content resonates deeply.
And then a call from Tim Cornell, the patron saint of the BFO community.
Tim Cornell called, expressing surprise that Big Fatty wasn't at IML, the International Mr. Leather Convention in Chicago, for Memorial Day weekend. Big Fatty clarified that he had attended the 25th anniversary 5 years prior, which gave him a pass for the 30th anniversary of this year. It shows that his core network keeps very close tabs on his whereabouts and his social schedule.
And finally, an update from Bill, the gay construction worker, calling from Orlando, already immersed in the Gay Days atmosphere.
Bill's call is just pure, unadulterated BFO chaos. He mentioned meeting a fat, big guy and casually noted that he has a twin brother, the gay one, even though Bill himself claims not to be gay. It's a perfect slice of the explicit, nonstop flow of information that Big Fatty curates, reinforcing the hedonistic environment he's about to enter.
He wraps up the Tuesday show by giving the digital roadmap for the trip.
He does. He reiterates that updates and critically pictures will be posted at podcastgaze.blogspot.com. He ensures the audience knows that the audio content is only half the story. The visual documentation is where the ruination truly becomes visible. The preparation is complete, the car is rolling, and the content is locked in.
Moving into Wednesday, June 4th, episode 89, we hit a structural milestone. This episode concluded the long-running content series, Growing Old and Gay with Annie Vera Charles. This biographical miniseries was vital in providing depth and history.
It was, covering their lives decade by decade. But in classic BFO style, the conclusion was marred by a technical failure, which Big Fatty immediately converted into content.
How did he handle it?
He just admitted he forgot to hit the record button for the segment where they discussed their 20s.
Oh, no.
So the series concluded, but a whole decade of their shared biographical history went undocumented for the BFO audience. He used this lapse, this failure of execution, as a talking point, reinforcing the charmingly ruined aesthetic of the show's production standards. Meanwhile, Annie Vera made sure to promote her site, Verix.com, leveraging the exposure from the series' conclusion.
The following day, Thursday, June 5th, which is BFO 90, brings us back to the promised structural anchor of the trip, the Memory Lane music.
And this one hit a really specific nostalgic chord. It was The New Adventures of Winnie the Pooh, the animated series that ran on ABC from 1988 to 1991. Big Fatty expressed his deep affection for the show, specifically mentioning the character Digger Doo. This themed opening instantly connects his current Disney environment with his personal history and, his childhood emotional attachments.
After the nostalgia, he dives immediately into the Wednesday travel recap, and the first piece of information is about his physical state. He sounds utterly spent.
He was feeling exhausted, a level of emotional honesty that resonates immediately. They had successfully driven most of Tuesday night and checked into the Pop Century Hotel early Wednesday morning.
He provides the precise logistical detail for the listeners. They were staying in the 90s decade building of the resort. Why is that specific hotel detail so important to share?
It creates a specific visual for the listener. It's like giving geographical metadata for the episode. The first order of business, crucially, wasn't hitting the parks. It was a nip-a-nap.
And their nap strategy reveals their contrasting travel personalities, doesn't it?
It really does. Big Fatty needed total sensory deprivation. He slept in the room, which he kept at a cool 68 degrees and described as an Arctic tundra, with his fan running for white noise.
Mm.
Larry Cly, on the other hand, opted for the public, social nap, sleeping outside by the computer-shaped pool. This contrast, the host retreating into a self-imposed deep freeze, the co-host relaxing publicly, is a perfect snapshot of their respective approaches to travel and downtime.
After the nap, they headed out for what he colorfully called a poopy day at Universal Studios and Islands of Adventure. But we start with the mandatory meal update.
Of course. Breakfast was quick and functional. A breakfast burrito with eggs, bacon, and cheese, along with a fruit yogurt. He made sure to note that he notably did not eat the granola in the yogurt, demonstrating his meticulous reporting on even the smallest dietary choices.
At Universal Studios, they rode the new Simpsons ride, but the experience was immediately ruined by crowd management and that intense Florida heat.
It was hot as shush, which immediately elevates the tension. Big Fatty was actively annoyed because the lines weren't opened up properly, forcing them to stand in the direct sun. They also rode the Jimmy Neutron ride, which had previously been the Hanna-Barbera ride, and his frustration wasn't limited to the heat. His annoyance peaked when he was bothered by an attendant screaming instructions at guests, noting he just wanted to punch her in the nose.
That deep dive into his personal annoyance is exactly what his audience craves. It validates their own low-level frustrations with the theme park experience.
Exactly. It's a transcription of everyday theme park annoyance into hilarious commentary. The mood didn't improve much as they moved to Islands of Adventure. They walked through Dr. Seuss Land, where Big Fatty was feeling very poopy, a catch-all term for being run down, hot, and, existentially miserable.
And the cure for this misery, the simplest, most indulgent form of comfort.
The lowbrow therapeutic intervention, the waffle cone of ice cream, which, he confirmed, made him feel a lot better.
Of course it did.
It's the ritual of consumption overriding exhaustion. Meanwhile, Larry Klein, needing something salty, ate French fries that were apparently so bad they required ketchup and tickle juice to be salvaged. Big Fatty stuck to a reliable large Coca-Cola.
And this is where their network connections start paying off, transitioning the show from personal frustration to a social experience.
They finally met up with Michael from QCast, an essential figure in the RNL network. Michael joined them at Islands of Adventure, and they rode the Spider-Man ride together. The network, this collection of associated podcasters, is the essential social structure that underpins this entire trip.
And Michael delivered the key observation about Big Fatty's physical presence that week.
Michael noticed Big Fatty's summer facial hair, which Big Fatty himself named the landing strip.
The landing strip?
Big Fatty confirmed he had to change it up and be a chameleon. This is a micro update to his brand identity. It's fascinating that even on the road, he treats his appearance as part of the performative content, noting the subtle shifts and inviting commentary.
The segment wrapped up with an update on Superb, another key community figure.
Superb was notably absent because he was reportedly busy cleaning toilets and baking goods in preparation for the arrival of Fairy Princess Holly, Big Fatty's daughter, who is scheduled to arrive on Thursday at 2 p.m. This detail connects the logistical preparation of the network friends, that's Superb, to the emotional preparation for family Holly's arrival. The community is organizing around the host and his family.
Moving to Friday's show, BFO 91, which recaps Thursday's activities, we get the next installment of Memory Lane Music, the extended version of the Mickey Mouse Club theme.
He went deep into the history of the show, didn't he? It shows his specific, almost academic knowledge of television history.
He really did. He detailed the original run from 1955 to 1959, listing original Musketeers like Annette Funicello and Bobby Burgess, and mentioning the creation of special segments like Spinning and Marty. This depth of cultural knowledge acts as a subtle flex for the audience, demonstrating that his nostalgia is genuine and well-researched.
Thursday morning was a necessary slower start, recognizing the toll the sudden departure and park heat had taken.
Yeah, you can tell he's run down.
They slept in until about 8:30 a.m. Big Fatty noted he was thoroughly pooped out, giving himself the wonderfully self-deprecating nickname, the Poop Deck Pappy.
Poop Deck Pappy.
Breakfast was a staple. A sausage biscuit, which he insisted was best consumed with yellow mustard, a specific recommendation he shared with his audience.
Then they were off to Animal Kingdom, and the day immediately established a ritual that defined the trip.
Yes. Larry Cly started the day with pork egg rolls and various sauces. But the key structural element of the day was the drinking. Big Fatty started drinking margaritas before noon, specifically 10 minutes to 12. His analysis. You know it's going to be a good day when the drinking starts before noon.
Huh.
This ritual instantly signals that the day is dedicated to relaxation and indulgence, setting a celebratory, boundary-pushing tone for the content.
The main attraction was seeing their friend Michael from QCast perform in the Finding Nemo show, and Big Fatty's description of Michael's versatility and roles is legendary.
It highlights Michael's professionalism, juxtaposed with Big Fatty's irreverent description. Michael played multiple parts. He waved a big squid, he sang and danced as Bruce the Shark, he was the fish orchestra leader, and in Big Fatty's specific terms, he played a turtle's ass.
A turtle's ass.
That explicit, crude description is precisely the kind of unfiltered detail that his audience expects and celebrates. It takes a shine off the Disney performance and makes it BFO specific.
Post-show, the network connection granted them some pretty rare access.
Michael invited them backstage where they met his co-star, Dory. This is a moment of exclusive behind-the-scenes access granted solely through the RNL network connection, showing the tangible benefits of being part of this podcasting community.
But the next anecdote is, structurally, one of the most brilliant pieces of spontaneous content for the entire week. The free ice cream sandwich incident. It combines flirtation, self-deprecation, and a high-stakes cliffhanger.
It is a perfect micro-narrative. They stopped at the McDonald's French fry cart, and Big Fatty went to buy an ice cream sandwich. A cute little guy working behind the cart noticed Big Fatty's pewter necklace, which was a gift from Michael from Stuttgart.
Wait, so the necklace, a symbol of his community connections, acted as a social signal?
Absolutely. It wasn't just a piece of jewelry. It was a conversation starter linked to his network. The worker, instead of taking payment, gave him the sandwich for free, saying, "That's okay," and giving him a smile.
This moment of unexpected flirtation genuinely surprised Big Fatty, who admitted he had never gotten hit on at Walt Disney World before. But the immediate analysis provided by Larry Cly is where the dynamic really shines.
Larry Cly, ever the jokester and straight man, offered the immediate, unhelpful, and completely on-brand analysis that the flirtation only happened because I'm fat. It immediately converts a moment of romantic possibility into a piece of hilarious, self-deprecating BFO content.
But Big Fatty, the content professional, recognized the moment's potential. He didn't just eat the sandwich. He capitalized on the interaction.
He did. He immediately returned, borrowed the guy's pen, and wrote down his contact information.
Yeah.
He turned a mundane retail exchange into a high-stakes romantic cliffhanger for the audience, confirming he'd see if Big Fatty gets a call from Little Ice Cream Man. This is the instant creation of serialized content from everyday life.
After that excitement, they continued snacking through the park.
Larry Cly ate a massive Italian sandwich at Pizza Safari Turkey, ham, two cheeses, and Caesar salad inside, along with chips, while Big Fatty had a cinnamon churro. Big Fatty observed that there were fewer gays at Animal Kingdom than he had expected, perhaps signaling that Gay Day's attendees were concentrating their efforts at the other parks.
And then, the experience that became the single most talked about piece of content from the week, Expedition Everest.
This is the pinnacle of the Ruination content. Mm-hmm. Big Fatty described the roller coaster vividly, claiming it will make you show yourself, and then added without hesitation that he kindly obliged and show myself.
Let's just pause there. The willingness to share this intensely personal, physically humiliating moment with thousands of listeners is the structural core of Big Fatty's success. It's an act of radical vulnerability.
It removes any veneer of dignity. It converts potential embarrassment into a trophy of public honesty. Most people would delete this from their memory, but Big Fatty immediately records and publishes it. It's the ultimate confirmation that nothing is too personal or too humiliating to be monetized into content. And it's why his audience feels such an intimate connection to him.
After that experience, they return to the room for a swimming app, presumably to clean up and relax before the evening's main event.
Which was the Sleuths Mystery Dinner Theater for the Rosam Tosam Show, starring Michael from QCast. This was the highly anticipated RNL Network meetup.
Who was on the guest list for this massive gathering? It sounded like a who's who of the BFO extended universe.
It was a substantial convergence. Super B, Miss Holly, Big Fatty's daughter, Jason and Ryan from the Way We See It podcast, and Kitty Patootie, who is Jonathan. Big Fatty captured the emotional dynamics immediately. He noted meeting Holly and Super B outside, confirming that Super B was perfectly horrified by his presence, and Holly jokingly regretted having him as a long-lost father. The humor revolves around Big Fatty's own recognized persona as an agent of social chaos.
Tell us about the dinner itself, because the details are extensive, right down to the price.
He ordered the prime rib for a $3 upcharge, noting it was huge. He only ate about half served with a baked potato and steamed vegetables. Dessert was strawberry shortcake for him and chocolate cake for Holly. Crucially, he noted that wine, beer, and soft drinks were all you can eat and drink, confirming the atmosphere was conducive to network bonding and general excess.
The show wasn't just passive viewing. He confirmed he was actively involved in the social dynamics of the event.
He was elected the table spokesman, giving him a central role in the show's interactive mystery element. And two of his companions, Larry Cly and Kitty Patootie, correctly guessed the murderer and won a special sheriff's badge prize. The evening was a success, not just socially, but competitively.
And the most memorable quote from the entire evening came from one of the drunken characters. Why did this specific quote stick with Big Fatty?
One of the characters, when awakened, said, "Sometimes my pee smells like ham."
What?
Big Fatty instantly recognized this line as valuable, absurdist content and immediately archived it for the show. Why it stuck is because it's perfectly surreal, unexpected, and utterly meaningless. The kind of random absurdity that works perfectly when contrasted with the specific, detailed reality of his own life.
He also made sure to mention the financial detail of the event.
He was sure to thank Michael from QCast for making the arrangements and using a good coupon. This is a classic BFO touch. Despite the extravagance of the dinner and the all-you-can-drink atmosphere, the fact that a good coupon was used grounds the entire experience in relatable consumer thrift.
Finally, he laid out the future plans for Friday, confirming the continued structure of the trip.
Yep. Tomorrow, which was Friday, they planned to go to the EPO Epcot for a gathering to see Michael in the Journey into Imagination Pavilion. This just confirms Michael's central role as the content facilitator. The day will conclude with fish and chips and margaritas from the Mexico Pavilion, followed by the big Italian hoot nanny, the Manny Nommels, hosted by Ryan and Jason. The schedule for the rest of Gay Days is packed, structured around food, network friends, and theme park visits.
This week was really defined by Big Fatty successfully translating his domestic reality into a functional, if chaotic, travel content strategy. And the use of that memory lane music was the key structural stabilizer.
It really was. We had the 1982 World's Fair music, a powerful piece of regional nostalgia, the new Adventures of Winnie the Pooh theme, and the classic Mickey Mouse Club theme.
Yeah.
This rotating schedule provided cultural touchstones that anchored the listener in a sense of familiarity, even as Big Fatty was careening from one chaotic event to the next, hundreds of miles away. It's a subtle way of ensuring continuity.
And the other vital anchor was the digital commitment. the Gay Days blog.
Yes, podcastgaydays.blogspot.com. He continuously reinforced the importance of the blog for visual documentation and updates throughout the trip, noting that some of the pictures already posted were quite horrifying.
Oh.
The blog serves as the designated repository for the visual evidence of the ruination, the proof that all the chaos he describes actually happened.
We also saw the audience engaging directly with the content, even offering dissent, which Big Fatty seems to welcome.
Absolutely. Listener Tom called in to say he thought the Indiana Jones movie sucked big time, directly contradicting Big Fatty's earlier positive review. This acceptance of dissent is vital. It proves that BFO is a genuine two-way conversation, not a monologue, and listeners feel comfortable challenging the host's opinion.
And despite the high level of engagement, Big Fatty still felt the need to issue a very direct, forceful call to action.
He did. He complained that listeners were taking a vacation from calling the fat one, recognizing that the content machine requires constant fuel from his audience. He then urged his audience to call the voicelet number 206-337-1438 and to give me your good gosh and gay me.
He's not passively waiting for content. He's actively demanding it.
Exactly. He's ensuring that listener input remains the central driver of the show's narrative flow.
Finally, he wrapped the week by confirming that the shows would continue daily through the trip, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Monday, and Tuesday, including the scheduled return of the gays on Juneteenth. His commitment to daylight content is absolute, regardless of his location, his exhaustion, or his internal bodily functions.
This week, episodes 87 through 91 perfectly encapsulated the BFO ethos. Big Fatty's success is built upon his commitment to delivering daily, intimate content while navigating these intense personal and logistical challenges.
We watched him take the ultimate domestic failure, the washing machine dying, and the trauma of the room in underpants, and transform it into a relatable content narrative. He seamlessly moved from high-stakes regional planning, like the terrifying I-26 reversal logistics, to deeply personal vulnerability, being poopy at Universal, the flirtation with the ice cream man, and the total physical humiliation of shooting himself on Expedition Everest.
The structure of the planned Gay Days updates, anchored by the Memory Lane music, provided the essential framework, stabilizing the relentless chaos of networking, consumption, and spontaneous interaction. He is not just broadcasting his life. He's actively performing self-inflicted ruination for the reward of community engagement and content generation.
So if we look at the bigger picture, Big Fatty essentially monetized every inconvenience, every failure, and every moment of physical discomfort, from his broken washer to the potential social rejection from a free ice cream sandwich.
The provocative thought for you, the listener, is this. Consider if the current trend of radical oversharing on social media, where vulnerability is a commodity, actually finds its roots in this early podcasting era. Big Fatty wasn't aiming for aesthetic perfection. He was deliberately aiming for and sharing imperfection. What is the embarrassing moment in your life that you could reframe and market as engaging community-building content? What is the value of your own ruin?
That structural willingness to share the absolute worst parts of his day is the secret ingredient to the enduring success of BFO. Thank you for joining us for this extensive deep dive into the archives. I'm King.
And I'm Gail.
Crucially, tune in next weekend for the newest episode of Ruination, The Early Years.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination, The Early Years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.